This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. W.S. Merwin with Robert Haas, recorded in Santa Fe, October 26, 2005. William S. Merwin is one of America's most read and much-loved poets. His numerous books speak to his pacifist and environmentalist beliefs, and he reads in this program a variety of poems, beginning with one written in Santa Fe in 1969, up to present work, before joining in conversation with noted fellow poet and friend, Robert Haas.
Good evening. I'm Robert Haas, and it's my pleasure to welcome you on behalf of the Lannan Foundation. Been sponsoring this extraordinary series for so many years, and to introduce William Merwin, W.S. Merwin, who is one of the amazing poets, amazing writers in the English language in the past half century. Let me tell you, some of you people from the outreach of the Lannan Foundation who may not know too much about American poets, a little bit about him, where he comes from and who he is. He was born in New Jersey, son of a Presbyterian minister, in 1927, the last years of the decade of F. Scott Fitzgerald. America poised to become an imperial power, and also poised on the edge of a Great Depression. His father became pastor of a church in Union City, New Jersey, on the Palisades, overlooking the Hudson River and the skyline of Manhattan. He lived there until he was 9 years old, when the family moved to Scranton. That would have been in the depth of Depression, in a coal mining part of Pennsylvania, and that was where he spent his early adolescent years. There and at a prep school, a seminary, to which, as the child of a Presbyterian minister, he received a scholarship. Now, World War II is beginning to happen, and in those years, he applied to colleges, to the local university, which was Princeton University, where he was also a scholarship student. He arrived during the years of the war at the age of 16. He was, as he writes in some of his books, always a little bit precocious and so a little bit young for his class. In this, he was like several other American poets, including Ezra Pound, who was always the young kid in his class, and also probably the brightest. At Princeton, in the 1940s, there were not very many students who were not military students. There are not very many young men. William Merwin was there because he was so young. And he arrived at a quite amazing moment, because one of the most important literary critics and best literary minds of that time, a man named R.P. Blackmore, whose essays you young poets should read, was teaching there, and he had brought the young poet John Barryman as an instructor. And William Merwin, as a scholarship student, had a job waiting table in the cafeteria, in the dining hall, where another scholarship student was waiting table, who was going to turn out to be another of the important American poets of the second half of the 20th century, Galway Kinnell. So during this period, when William Merwin was teaching himself to ride on the polo ponies that were no longer in use of the Princeton students, because all the rich kids were not there or off at the war, he was too young to go to war, he found himself apprenticed to some of the best literary intelligences and most interesting artists of his time. And it was during that period that he also took a bus ride to Washington, D.C., to meet Ezra Pound, who was incarcerated at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in a madhouse. And it was partly Pound's encouragement that sent William Merwin on the path of studying medieval Spanish literature, which was going to reverberate in really surprising ways in his poetry and in, therefore in the poetry of the second half of the 20th century. So at 19 years old, he graduates from college because college was accelerated to 3 years. At 20, he begins graduate school in Romance languages and falls into a job as a tutor to the young son of a wealthy New York family who has a summer estate in New Jersey. In fact, the Stuyvesant family, descended from Peter Stuyvesant, who owned Manhattan. And through the Stuyvesant family, he's invited to become the tutor to one of the nephews of a Stuyvesant the following summer on the Riviera. You know, you guys worrying about what to do after college? Here's an answer. Get a job as a tutor to a student in a villa on the Riviera. It's a good job. And there he was able to work at his French, and that led to an invitation from the sister of the pretender to the Portuguese royal throne to tutor her children in Portugal the following fall, which led him to a trip to Mallorca, where he met the English poet Robert Graves, author of I, Claudius, the novel, and got an invitation to tutor his son. And so, age 20, 21, 22, in Europe, in a ruined Europe in the aftermath of World War II, William Merwin, writing his first poems, in love with the poetry of William Butler Yeats, everyone was in love with in those years, began to write his poems. By 1952, he had his first book of poems selected by W.H. Auden for the Yale Younger Poets series, as auspicious a beginning as any poet could hope for in those years. And he was a real writer, 1952, with a book of poems and this odd life in Europe, which then bounced him to London. And from that has proceeded, by my count, something like 18 books of poems, perhaps 20 books of translations of poetry. He's certainly the most important literary translator of the last 50 years, and a group of extraordinary prose books as well. His life took him back and forth between the France, southern France that he fell in love with in those years, and New York, place he glimpsed from his childhood, literary capital of America, through, with a stay in London, through the 1950s and the 1960s. In the 1970s, his life, this Odissean life, took another turn toward Hawaii, where he spent time and developed an ecological passion that led him to collect and try to preserve against the onslaught of pineapple monoculture as many native palms of the Hawaiian Islands as possible in the place where he was living. And in the meantime, he was writing these books. He translated, to give you a sense of his work in translation, he translated almost all, and these are the translations you want to read if you read them, translated almost all of the important poems of medieval romance literature. Poem of the Cid, The Song of Roland. He's done a translation of Dante's Purgatorio, a stunning book of early Spanish ballads. Recently, he stretched his medieval interests into England and done a translation of Gawain and the Green Knight, and he translated the important picaresque novel of that period, Lazarillo de Tormes. For me, as a writer some 10 or 15 years younger, it was his translations of contemporary poetry that mattered in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, each one of them a revelation. He's one of the first people to translate Pablo Neruda into English. His translations of Jean Follain's poetry, a French surrealist poet, were enormously influential. He was the first translator of Osip Mandelstam, the great Russian poet who died in the Stalin's gulags. He's translated the poets important to poets, but still not so well known by the general reader, the Argentine poet Roberto Juarez and the Mexican poet Jaime Sabines. In the Hawaii years, his spiritual interest turned towards Zen Buddhism and also toward the toward Asian poetries, and a collection of his translations of Asian poetries have recently been translated, including one of the delicious books of the last few years, a book called Asian Figures, which is translation of folk sayings and folk songs and folk poems from a whole bunch of different Asian cultures. A Poundian enterprise to try to bring the tang of popular thought from a whole bunch of living cultures unavailable to English and to the American ignorance of other cultures into English. I'll quote for you right now a poem of his, a translation of his, of a Vietnamese folk poem. I guarantee you, once you hear it, you're never going to forget it. It's a short poem. It goes like this. Spit straight up. Learn something. I wanted to give you a sense of the three main phases of his poetry. There used to be a joke about Henry James, that there were three phases of Henry James' art. James the First, James the Second, and James the Old Pretender. I'm not sure that you could say that exactly about William Merwin, but you could say there's a first Yeatsian Merwin, and a second Merwin who formed a completely original voice in American poetry, made partly out of Spanish and French surrealism, those sources that he did so much to bring into English and to naturalize, and a rangy, explosive work of the final years. Maybe you'll get to hear some of both. Let me give you a taste of his autobiography and hunger as a poet. This is from a poem written in the 90s, The River's Lament for the Maker. The secret was still there, safe in the unprotected air. That breath that in its own words only sang when I was a child to me and caught me helpless to convey it, with nothing but the words to say it, though it was those words completely, and they rang, it was clear to me, with the changeless overtone I have listened for since then, hearing that note endlessly vary every time beyond me, trying to find where it comes from and to what words it may come, and forever after be present for the thought kept at me that my mother and every day of our lives would slip away like the summer, and suddenly all would have been taken from me. But the presence I had known, sometimes in words, would not be gone. And if it spoke even once for me, it would stay there and be me. This is that quest of these 40, 50 years of writing poetry. Please welcome William Merwin.
Thank you, Robert, for that wonderfully generous and eloquent and rich introduction. And I want to thank Patrick Lannan and the Lannan Foundation and everyone who's responsible for my wife and my being back here. I've loved Santa Fe for many, many years, and as long ago as 1969, when many of you were not born, spent a wonderful winter here in a house out on the old Santa Fe Trail, and have always remained extremely, had the fondest memories of Santa Fe and all of the country around it. And it's a joy to find myself back here again. I want to read in chronological order, but not in pedantic chronological order. And I want to begin with some poems that were written back about the time when I was living that winter out on the, just beyond what was then the old Navajo Museum, in that house of John Means. This is a poem, but you'll immediately see what it has to do with the landscape here. It's a very tiny poem called The Old Boast. Listen, natives of a dry place, from the harpist's fingers, rain. And another poem, and these are dry land poems. Early one summer. Years from now, someone will come upon a lair of birds and not know what he is listening for. These are the days when the beetles hurry through dry grass, hiding pieces of light they have stolen. Something I've not done. I suppose this comes from the Robert talked about my Presbyterian upbringing. I hope it's not just, not, I hope that's not the only source of it. Something I've not done is following me. I haven't done it again and again. So it has many footsteps like a drumstick that's grown old and never been used. In late afternoon, I hear it come closer. At times it climbs out of a sea onto my shoulders and I shrug it off, losing one more chance. Every morning it's drunk up part of my breath for the day and knows which way I'm going, and already it's not done there. But once more I say I'll lay hands on it tomorrow and add its footsteps to my heart and its story to my regrets and its silence to my compass. And then a poem that is probably a kind of key poem of that time among my poems is called The Unwritten. Inside this pencil crouch words that have never been written, never been spoken, never been taught. They're hiding. They're awake in there, dark in the dark, hearing us. But they won't come out. Not for love, not for time, not for fire. Even when the dark has worn away, they'll still be there, hiding in the air. Multitudes in days to come may walk through them, breathe them, be none the wiser. What script can it be that they won't unroll? In what language? Would I recognize it? Would I be able to follow it, to make out the real names of everything? Maybe there aren't many. It could be that there's only one word and it's all we need. It's here, in this pencil. Every pencil in the world is like this. I see, as I read a group of poems from this period, what they have in common. But of course, they were not things I planned for them to have in common, and I look back on them. And we understand things in reverse, you know, not ever the other way around, alas. But the search. When I look for you, everything falls silent. A crowd seeing a ghost. It is true. Yet I keep on trying to come toward you, looking for you. Roads have been paved, but many paths have gone, footprint by footprint, that led home to you, when roads already led nowhere. Still, I go on hoping as I look for you, one heart walking in long, dry grass on a hill. Around me, birds vanish into the air, shadows flow into the ground. Before me, stones begin to go out like candles, guiding me. This is a poem from at least a decade and a half later, a poem called Yesterday. My friend says, I was not a good son, you understand. I say, yes, I understand. He says, I did not go to see my parents very often, you know. And I say, yes, I know. Even when I was living in the same city, he says, maybe I would go there once a month or maybe even less. I say, oh, yes. He says, the last time I went to see my father, I say, the last time I saw my father, he says, the last time I saw my father, he was asking me about my life, how I was making out. And he went into the next room to get something to give me. Oh, I say, feeling again the cold of my father's hand the last time. He says, and my father turned in the doorway and saw me look at my wristwatch. And he said, you know, I would like you to stay and talk with me. Oh, yes, I say. But if you are busy, he said, I don't want you to feel that you have to just because I'm here. I say nothing. He says, my father said, maybe you have important work you are doing, or maybe you should be seeing somebody. I don't want to keep you. I look out the window. My friend is older than I am. He says, and I told my father it was so, and I got up and left him then, you know. Though there was nowhere I had to go, and nothing I had to do. In a poem from a little bit later, that same time, The Black Jewel. In the dark, there is only the sound of the cricket. South wind in the leaves is the cricket. So is the surf on the shore and the barking across the valley. The cricket never sleeps. The whole cricket is the pupil of one eye. It can run, it can leap, it can fly. In its back, the moon crosses the night. There is only one cricket when I listen. The cricket lives in the unlit ground, in the roots, out of the wind. It has only the one sound. Before I could talk, I heard the cricket under the house. Then I remembered summer. Mice, too, and the blind lightning are born hearing the cricket. Dying, they hear it. Bodies of light turn listening to the cricket. The cricket is neither alive nor dead. The death of the cricket is still the cricket. In the bare room, the luck of the cricket echoes. And then the poem, Looking Back. So I suppose I was getting older. But, you know, we're questioned about that, and I believe that memory is basically what we have. And that there's something that I get to be suspicious of people who love to sort of downplay memory all the time and talk about it as pure nostalgia or something. There are lots of ways of doing that. Because I think, you know, a lot of the fear of death is fear of loss of memory. We're all in this room tonight because we remembered where it was, because we remember something about the language that we share, because of lots of things that are pure memory. We didn't make the whole thing up. So we're not totally in the present ever. We're almost always entirely in the past. We do different things with it, but we should respect it at least. Anyway, this is a poem of a kind of reminiscence. After school. For a long time, I wanted to get out of that school where I had been sent for the best. I thought of climbing down the vine outside the window at night after the watchman had turned the corner to the boiler room in the sweet autumn dark. I wanted to slip through the still dining hall and down the cellar stairs in the girls' wing, where I had set the waltzing in the first book of War and Peace. I would pass unseen in that crowd, into the cellar and the secret door to the steam pipes and under the street to the swimming pool. I would have persuaded a girl I liked to meet me there, and we would swim whispering because of the echoes, while the light from the street shone through the frosted windows like the light of the moon. All down the hot room where the sound of the water made the heart beat loud to think of it. But I never got away then, and when I think now of following that tunnel, there is a black wolf tied there waiting, a thin bitch who snaps at my right hand, but I untie her, and we find our way out of there as one, and down the street, hungry, nobody in sight at that hour, everything closed behind us. Another animal poem. I'm trying not to read just animal poems. I mean, I have a fixation with animals, but a happy one. But this one's called The Duck. The first time that I was allowed to take out the white canoe, because the lake was so still in the evening, I slipped out on the long sky of midsummer across the light coming through the overturned dark trees. I saw the dusk catching the colors of fire as she moved over the bright glass, and I glided after until she dove and I followed with the white canoe. And look what I find long afterwards, the world of the living. I read that poem partly because of two friends who are here tonight. When I read that poem years ago in New Jersey, they came up to me, and it turned out that they were running canoe trips, and Beverly invited me to come along on a canoe trip, and my wife and I took several canoe trips with them, very wonderful times, and into the Sea of Cortez. They still live near Santa Fe and have a wonderful dog shelter north of town. Place. On the last day of the world, I would want to plant a tree. What for? Not for the fruit. The tree that bears the fruit is not the one that was planted. I want the tree that stands in the earth for the first time, with the sun already going down and the water touching its roots in the earth full of the dead, and the clouds passing one by one over its leaves. And there's a companion poem to that one, which is a very, very short poem called Witness. I want to tell what the forests were like. I will have to speak in a forgotten language. And then a poem closely related to those two, written some years later, which is a kind of, at once a ballad and a story, and it's called One Story. Always somewhere in the story, which up until now we thought was ours, whoever it was that we were being then had to wander out into the green, towering forest, reaching to the end of the world and beyond, older than anything whoever we were being could remember, and find there that it was no different from the story anywhere in the forest, and never be able to tell, as long as the story was there, whether the fiery voices, now far ahead, now underfoot, the eyes staring from their instant that held the story as one breath, the shadows offering their spread flowers, and the chill that leapt from its own turn through the hair of the nape like a light through a forest, knew the untold story all along and were waiting at the right place as the moment arrived for whoever it was to be led at last by the wiles of ignorance through the forest and come before them face to face for the first time, recognizing them with no names and again surviving, seizing something alive to take home out of the story. But what came out of the story, out of the forest, was all part of the story. Whatever died on the way or was named but no longer recognizable, even what vanished out of the story, finally, day after day, was becoming the story. So that when there is no more story, that will be our story. When there is no forest, that will be our forest. There's a book that that follows in the 90s. Called The Vixen. All of the poems are the same form, which is an elegiac form, and all of them are set in the same place. They're set in a part of southwestern France that I stumbled into when I was in my early 20s, and where I had, I think, a little over $1,200 to my name, well, total, which is a lot of money for me. And because an aunt had died and left it to me. And I found a ruined farmhouse, and it cost $1,200, and I bought it. So then I was broke, but I had a ruined farmhouse with holes in the roof. So it became part of my life, and we go back there with frequent flyer miles whenever we can, for at least about once a year, maybe twice. It's a very long way from Hawaii. But it's a place with an enormous kind of continuity, sense of continuity, sense of age, which I found absolutely hypnotizing. Still do. We found last year that within walking distance of the old Lascaux entrance, a paleontologist for 50 years has been working on a totally unrecorded, an undescribed area. He won't describe it because the French government wouldn't allow him to continue excavation, so they have this standoff with each other. But he's discovered a Neanderthal burial with a bear buried beside it that he believes is three times as old as Lascaux. Now, this is a place of the world, part of the world with an enormous sense of age. And there's a great sense of age in right here, too, as you know, and it's part of its great attractions to me. But this is one poem out of that book, The Vixen, and The Vixen is the kind of spirit guide all through that book. Gate. Once I came back to the leaves just as they were falling into the rattling of magpies and the waving flights through treetops beyond the long field tawny with stubble. A scatter of sheep wandered there, circling slowly as a galaxy, ferrying the gray lights that were theirs, wading into their shadows with the stalks whispering under them and the day shining out of the straw, all the way to the break in the wall where the lane goes down into old trees to turn at the end and follow the side of the cliff. And I stopped there to look, as always, out over the hedgerows and the pastures lying face upward, filled with the radiance before sunset, one below the other down to the haze along the river, each of them broader than I had remembered them, like skies with sheep running molten in the lanes between them, clonking of sheep bells drifting up through the distance. I watched the shadow climbing the fields, and I turned uphill to come to the top gate and the last barn. The sun still in the day and my shadow going on out into the upland. And I saw they were milking. It was that hour. And it seemed all my friends were there, We greeted each other and we walked back out to the gate, talking, and saw the last light and our shadows gesturing far out along the ridge until the darkness gathered them. And we went on standing here, believing there were other words. We stood here talking about our lives in the autumn. Patrick Lannan is a great lover of birds, and there are many bird poems I could read, but I'll read this one called Orioles. It's a bird, the European oriole is a bird that I worry about. I worry about all birds, as a matter of fact, as you would too if you followed the bird counts from year to year, or even knew a place and knew the birds that had been there over the years. The song of the oriole began as an echo, but this year it was not heard afterward, or before, or at all. And only later would anyone notice what had not been there, when the cuckoo had been heard again, a calling shadow, but not the goldfinch with its gold, and not that voice through the waterfall, the oriole, flashing under the window among the trees, now at the end of the hall of the palace, one of the palaces. St. Augustine told about, here, he said, you enter into the great palaces of memory. And whose palaces were they? I wondered at first, knowing that he must have been speaking from memory of his own, of palaces of his own, with his own days echoing in the halls. Waves in August. There's a war in the distance, with the distance growing smaller. The field glasses lying at hand are for keeping it far away. I thought I was getting better about that returning childish wish to be living somewhere else that I knew was impossible. And now I find myself wishing to be here, to be alive here. It is impossible enough to still be the wish of a child. In youth, I hid a boat under the bushes beside the water, knowing I would want it later and come back and would find it there. Someone else took it and left me instead the sound of the water with its whisper of vertigo, terror, reassurance, an old, old sadness. It would seem we knew enough always about parting, but we have to go on learning. As long as there is anything. The new book of poems, the most recent, is called Present Company, and all the poems in it have got are in the second person. They're all addressed to some fiction or personification or person. Or every person, of course, is partly imaginary, so. But I mean, the idea, the first idea for a poem was one called To the Unlikely Event, because I didn't know how else to approach the unlikely event, which we're told about all the time. Everybody in this room, I expect, has been in an airplane and been warned about the unlikely event of a water landing. And I thought, well, there must be other unlikely events, and I wonder how. And I thought I'd write to unlikely events, but I mean, that didn't turn out to be very practical. So anything, I mean, this one is, for example, called To Lingering Regrets. Without wanting to, I have come slowly to admit that I know who you are one by one, O lovely and mournful, with downcast eyes, appearing to me as you are turning away to stand silent and late in a remembered light, touched with amber as the sun is going, from a day that it brought. You come to me again and again to wait as beautiful as ever. At the edge of the light, you have not changed at all, as far as I can tell. And you learn nothing from me who do not talk with you, but see you waiting there without once moving toward you Oh, forever hopeful and forever young, you are the foolish virgins with no oil for your lamps and no one else to lead you where you want to go. To my brother, our mother wrote to you before you were born, a note you might open at some later date in case she should not be there to tell you what was in her mind about wanting you when she had not seen you. That was before my time, and it never turned out like that. You never saw the letter, and she never saw you, who were perfect, they said, and dead within minutes that far ahead of me, and always looking the other way. And I would be the one to open the letter after she was gone. And you had answered it without a word before I was there to find out about you, unseen elder, you perfect one, firstborn. To luck. In the cards and at the bend in the road, we never saw you. In the womb and in the crossfire, in the numbers, whatever you had your hand in, which was everything, we were told never to put our faith in you, but to bow to you humbly after all, because in the end there was nothing else we could do. But we were not to believe in you. And though we might coax you with pebbles kept warm in the hand, or coins or relics of vanished animals, observances, rituals, none of them binding upon you who make no promises, we might do such things only not to neglect you and risk your disfavor, O you who are never the same, who are secret as the day when it comes, you whom we explain whenever we can without understanding. To forgetting. Queen of the night, whose reign began before, always before. Mother of how the story goes, song older than singing. You sweep up my footsteps. How did I find my way here? Now there's no way back. You blow my words away without my hearing you. You erase the faces even of the living. You travel backward wherever you are going, taking the days with you, all of them, even the ones I imagined were safe forever. Sovereign of terrible freedom, O you without feature and without end, whose face I never see or never remember, how can I love you? Except when you appear for a moment wearing the veils and the long train of memory, disguised as memory, the queen of the day. Now, I would like, for the rest of the reading time, to read a few poems that have not been published in a book. A few of them have been in magazines, but they're all of them otherwise unfindable, as you see. Hidden. And I'll start with the one that is probably the most recent. It's called Blueberries After Dark. I'm particularly fond of blueberries. Always have been. And I used to feel guilty about it, because I thought the bears want blueberries too, and I, you know, but now apparently they're all cultivated, so the bears probably get fenced out anyway. Blueberries After Dark. So this is the way the night tastes, one at a time, not early nor late. My mother told me that I was not afraid of the dark. And when I looked, it was true. How did she know so long ago? With her father dead, almost before she could remember, and her mother following him not long after. And then her grandmother, who had brought her up, and a little later, her only brother, and then her firstborn, gone as soon as he was born. She knew. There's a poem here that I also want to read, if I can find it, for Patrick. But I can't find it, so never mind. You'll be spared that one. It's hidden in the shuffle back there. What I do want to read is several poems that are all elegiac, and they're all recent, and they all have to do with dogs. By Dark. When it is time, I follow the black dog into the darkness that is the mind of day. I can see nothing there but the black dog, the dog I know, going ahead of me, not looking back. Oh, it is the black dog I trust now in my turn after the years when I had all the trust of the black dog through an age of brightness and through shadow, on into the blindness of the black dog, where the rooms of the dark were already known and had no fear in them for the black dog, leading me carefully up the blind stairs. Just goodbye, a good night. It's kind of lullaby poem. Sleep softly, my old love, my beauty in the dark. Night is a dream we have, as you know, as you know. Night is a dream you know, an old love in the dark around you as you go, without end as you know. In the night where you go, sleep softly, my old love, without end in the dark, in the love that you know. At the bend. I look for you, my curl of sleep, my breathing wave on the night shore, my star in the fog of morning. I think you can always find me. I call to you under my breath. I whisper to you through the hours, all your names, my ear of shadow. I think you can always hear me. I wait for you, my promised day, my time again, my homecoming, my being where you wait for me. I think always of you waiting. At the same time that I was writing those poems, this is a kind of answer when Robert talked about translations and about the visit to Pound and about my starting translations when I was about 18, I suppose. A lifelong schooling and source and all sorts of things that I found out as I went. But there was a poem that I encountered then, which is lovely. It was in Latin. 6 very short lines by the Emperor Hadrian. And we know very little about his other poetry. We know that he always loved it. It's a poem called, that begins, Animula Vagula Blandula. Many of you may know it. And over the years, I've known it. And every time I found a translation of it, I looked at it very carefully and had various opinions about the translations, and in French too. And just this recently, in recent months, I thought of the poem, remembered the poem again, and I suddenly, without even trying, I never thought of trying to translate it. I thought, that's the way I would like to have it in English, if it were ever in English. This is the poem. Animula means little soul. So that is, if it has a title, that's its title. Little soul, little stray, little drifter. Now where will you stay? All pale and all alone, after the way you used to make fun of things. The thing is that nobody knows to whom that poem was addressed or anything else about it much. There's one other poem that I want to read in, put in there. It comes out of Present Company. It comes out of the near the end of the last book, but I wanted to put it in here. It's called To Myself. Even when I forget you, I go on looking for you. I believe I would know you. I keep remembering you, sometimes long ago, but then other times I am sure you were here a moment before, and the air is still alive around where you were, and I think then I can recognize you who are always the same, who pretend to be time, but you are not time, and who speak in the words, but you are not what they say. You who are not lost when I do not find you. I'm going to look for that poem that I want for Patrick, if I see if I can find it. And then end with a different one. Here we are. It's another bird poem, you see, so that's why I wanted it in there. And this one is in the, it's the birds that are speaking. These are the European gray heron, and they're very strange and ghostly kind of bird, very beautiful. And they migrate, and of course, and they don't stand in a clump. I mean, they stand spread out in an area, very still. This is the herons speaking. Gray herons in the field above the river. Now that the nights turn longer than the days, we are standing in the still light after dawn, in the high grass of autumn that is green again, hushed in its own place after the burn of summer. Each of us stationed alone without moving, at a perfect distance from all the others, like shadows of ourselves risen out of our shadows. Each eye without turning continues to behold what is moving. Each of us is one of seven now. We have come a long way sailing our opened clouds, remembering all night where the world would be. The clear, shallow stream, the leaves floating along it, the dew in the hushed field, the only morning. And then I want to end with a poem called The Nomad Flute. You that sang to me once, sing to me now. Let me hear your long lifted note. Survive with me. The star is fading. I can think farther than that, but I forget. Do you hear me? Do you still hear me? Does your air remember you, O breath of morning, night song, morning song? I have with me all that I do not know. I have lost none of it. But I know better now than to ask you where you learned that music, where any of it came from. Once there were lions in China. I will listen until the flute stops and the light is old again. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
So I didn't get to say when I was introducing you that I was, for many of those stories, I was drawing on this very remarkable new prose book, The Summer Doorways, which is a memoir of those two summers of when you were 20 and 21 years old in New Jersey and then in Europe. I know that you've written a series of quite amazing books of prose in the last few years. Do you know where they came from?
Well, they came out of things that I remembered. The Lost Upland and Unframed Originals were the memoirs. I suppose the word memoir means what you remember in some way. I didn't think of them as autobiographies or fragments of autobiography nearly so much as I thought everybody feels that way. I thought of my childhood as kind of weird, and I thought nobody ever had such a weird, I mean everybody has very weird childhoods, but I thought nobody ever had this kind of weird childhood. And I thought, you know, there are things that if I don't soon write them down, I'll start forgetting them. So I tried to write down about these strange people, my father's family. My mother didn't have a family. She was, as the poems make clear, a complete orphan. And if any relatives of hers were so remotely connected to her that I never could have quite understand the connections. Mm-hmm. But my father's family was very strange, and I thought of them pretty much without exception as being eccentric. And you talk about the Presbyterian upbringing, it was very kind of incredibly sort of strict and stuffy and tight. My father's sister Edna, with whom we used to stay in New Kensington, he was Italian, that was wonderful. I mean, Alonzo was his name, Alonzo Porter, and Alonzo taught me to shoot pool, and he bought me the biggest ice creams, which I wasn't allowed to have because they were so big that they must be made out of heaven knows what, you know. So he'd buy them for me, and we would when we walked into town, we walked along the railroad tracks, which was strictly forbidden. And so I loved Port, you know. And he listened to the ball game without his false teeth, and I thought that was wonderful.
In The Summer Doorways, you say that when your father thought about you, it was principally to think about things you were forbidden to do.
It's true, I'm afraid. It's pretty sad. And I realized later how out of, you know, he must have felt like someone who can barely swim, who's way out of his depth, you know. Through most of his life, he was sort of scared. And he kept trying to pass. I mean, the last time that I said anything cross to him, and I only did that a few times in the course of our lives, were when he, when I was fairly grown up, I mean, and he said to me, I was down on the floor talking to a friend's dog, you know, petting the dog. And he said, oh, I wouldn't do that, you know, you might get bitten. And I got up and I said, I don't ever want you to say that to me again, you know, because you've been trying to make me afraid of living all my life, and please don't do it anymore.
One of the things about the body of your work that's so amazing is the sheer fertility of your imagination. You think that's connected to being told not to
do things? No, I mean, I read novelists sometimes, and I think, my goodness, what fertility of imagination. And I'm not a novelist, so I don't know. I suppose so, but those memoir books were simply trying to save that what I remembered, the strangeness of it and the oddity of it and the sense. I suppose I wonder whether this is general. The sense that this odd world that existed only in my memory was really me. It was in some sense me. So I didn't have to keep talking about me. All I had to talk about was it. And I realized that many great writers of fiction, that's true. I mean, in some sense it's true of even someone like Flaubert, you know, I mean, he's not writing about his remembered life so much, but he's writing out of memory all the time. And I
I think these four books, Unframed Originals, The Maze of Ventadorn, which is a both autobiography and a study of the Provençal poets and of the culture that you had immersed yourself in, and The Lost Upland about the south of France, and this new book, Summer Doorways, which is a book on the level of Nabokov's Speak Memory. I think the four of them together are going to be, as a volume, one of the classic books of American writing, completely eccentric in the way that they go about things. And it made me very curious about how, where they came from, and also how you manage the economy of writing prose and writing poetry.
Well, I don't know any more about that than where poems come from, but what I do know is that, and I have had, after all over the years, many friends who are prose writers, and I know that I don't go about that the same way they do, and I can think of suddenly conceiving of a piece of writing, it coming together like one of the short fiction prose pieces that I've written, suddenly knowing it, but not thinking that there's a subject that I want to write, or even if I do think of it as a subject, I spend 3 or 4 years without any idea of how I would do it, and then all of a sudden I think, oh, that's the way to do it, you know, that that's how it would happen. And there are subjects, there's one in The Lost Upland that haunted me for years after it happened, where I was living, it's true, I mean, they're true stories. I was living in this very, very remote house, a half-ruined house, out in far out in these half-barren uplands in southwestern France, and a neighbor's flock of sheep managed to break out through the brush at the bottom of their pasture fields and get onto the railroad tracks, and there was a horrible encounter at night with a train piled into them, and 35 sheep were just ground into hamburger. And that story and its relation to my life there and everybody around me was something that I was haunted by, as one would be, you know. It happened as close as from here to the other side of the street out there.
For the young writers here, I was visiting with some of them this morning at the College of Santa Fe. Do you do prose in the morning and poetry in the afternoon? Do you set yourself a schedule of so many hours a day to work?
I don't know what use this is to anyone else, but I do know that, I mean, yes, I do get up in the morning and I try to devote as much of the early part of the day as possible to, if not writing, the place where writing seems to come from, which is this sort of totally blank well, you know. And so I really don't want to hear the latest vile doings in Washington or anything like that until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, because that really breaks in on it and, you know, the whole thing is gone. And there were models as I grew up, and I think I'm very lucky about that. And the idea that someone could dedicate their lives to writing was something very precious to me. I mean, that was the origin of my going to see Ezra Pound when I knew nothing about his politics, fortunately. If I had, I knew very little about any politics, so I might have been struck by the unreality of the whole thing and gone to see him and then tried to work it out later. As, of course, we're all still trying to work out what the relation between Pound's poetry and his politics are. And there's no answer to that. François Villon is one of the worst men of that period in literature in France, and he was certainly, I think, the most beautiful poet in French. There's no good answer to that conundrum. But there were models. Graves was one when I tutored his children. He was... his son Graves was wonderful. He could go on with what he was with the rest of the sentence, having been interrupted in any way, any hour of the day or night. When I was at college, and by the way, Galway Connell and I were complete anachronisms of Princeton, of all places, you know, without a penny. I mean, we didn't have any money at all. You know? We're surrounded by these rich boys. All of the most interesting people there, we thought, were the people who were on scholarships who didn't have any money. But Hermann Bach, a great Austrian writer, lived there in town, as had, and so did Erich Kahler, and so had Thomas Mann. It had been an incredible group of great writers. And I would sometimes before I went to bed at night, take a walk down and look up and see Hermann Bach's attic window with the light still on. And I thought, Hermann's up there, he's up there working. You know? And I thought, how wonderful to have a life as focused on writing as that. And that's what I always wanted. And wherever I found that kind of dedication, I paid real attention to it. I certainly saw it in painters, I saw it in composers, and writers seem to be more scatty all over the place. But I realized later that it wasn't true, that they were simply doing it in a different way. I think that for young writers, two things are of immense importance. One of them is models, if they can find them. And the other is to have some older person whom they totally respect, who completely believes in them. And those two things are enough by themselves.
Has your sense of what poetry is for changed?
Yes, it has, and I still would find it very hard to describe. I really, in some sense, and this will sound crazy, people say, what is your audience? And I say, on the one hand, there's no audience. You're writing to the language. But on the other hand, the audience is everybody. I hope that by paying intense attention to what I can hear in language, I'm talking to everybody else's experience too. And I mean everybody else, whether they know it or not, whether they find it audible. I think of poetry as being audible. I think one of the differences between prose and poetry is that you have to hear poetry. Mm-hmm. That's why I stopped punctuation, because if you don't have punctuation, you have to hear it. Mm-hmm.
I was hearing in these last poems that you were reading, Yeatsian rhyme coming back into your poems.
It's buried here and there.
Which is in the poems you were writing when you were 20. Do you feel like you're closing
this? I hadn't thought about that at all, but that'd be wonderful. I mean,
I was saying after and remember and brother and sister and thinking. That's like the rhymes in the poems in The Drunk in the Furnace about family.
Yeah, I was always fascinated by those off rhymes of Yeats and by his meter too. You know, you're absolutely right. That Yeats, and the reverence for Yeats, which has never wavered. I mean, I feel is just sort of reverent by Yeats. We were at the tower, his tower, and at Lady Gregory's, the ruins of her house last year, and it was a wonderful moment.
You spoke about worrying about European orioles. Nature in the 1950s seemed like it was always going to be there.
Yeah.
Has the growing sense in the second half of the century of how imperiled the creature life of the planet is changed your writing?
Well, one thing that happened in my mind in the 50s, one of them was that I realized that I couldn't make the kind of absolute break in between the human species and every other kind of life in terms of anything, in terms of value or in terms of anything else. And I really believe that we are linked to everything back to the one-celled animals. I mean, there is no break. This is a continuum. And if you begin to get near such a sense of things, you're either terrified by it or you regard it as a great privilege to be part of that whole immense thing. Which means, of course, that you're part of the whole of the world, everything that's alive, everything that there is, and everything that doesn't seem to be alive. But I realized I had that troubling for me at first, troubling sense. But the feeling that not only were I was involved in the anti-nuclear movement, I was horrified by the idea of nuclear weapons. But I realized that I was horrified by the use.
This was London in the 1950s.
This was London, but it was before I went to London. Mm-hmm. Even before I went, I was beginning to be very upset about that. But I was also very 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 disreputable feelings about military activity altogether, about the organized use of violence, and organized by whom and for what purposes. And I've remained very suspicious of that. And I'm, you know, that does not mean a judgment on soldiers. That means a judgment on this aspect of humanity. Mm-hmm. And with that feeling about to try to limit nuclear, the whole nuclear enterprise of humanity, and stop nuclear testing, and everything that was part of it, I realized that this was not a sort of isolated activity, human activity, that the destruction of the environment and the destruction of human culture itself were all related. These were all related to each other, and that they probably, that the motives for them were related too. And this is a sort of moral web that I'm still trying to find my way through. I have very strong feelings about it. I've never been a pacifist, because I've been very close to being a pacifist for a very long time. But I can always imagine circumstances in which the only possible way of dealing with them is violent, and that I would condone and even become part of the violence. But I always think of it as a kind of moral defeat to be in that situation. Their relations besides the kind of historic numbing terror of all of them, when I think of the deaths of species, the racing curve at which it's happening, the speed with which it's happening, words have always died and species have always died, but not at the present rate, and that death is absolute, and there's no way of bringing it back. You can't bring back an extinct species. You probably can't bring back extinct words. You know, words have always died. Cultural phenomena have always died, but not at the rate they're dying now. I don't know. I have no glib answer to that, mm-hmm. but I don't want to turn away from it either. And I don't think it's alien to what makes us love the arts, and what makes us love poetry, and what makes us turn to poetry in times of feeling absolutely helpless to say things. I think probably language was born at the beginning because people couldn't express themselves. They invented words and sounds to express things.
One of the young poets this morning asked me if I thought that poets were different from other people in this business of expression. And I said, wait, we'll ask someone who might have something to say.
I think poets are different just the way everybody else is different, you know. I think the difference probably is a kind of stubborn adherence to something. I think that everybody, I believe, I'm maybe totally wrong about this, but I believe that children must all at some point find words fascinating and find that just the sound and the feeling and the savor of words strange. And if that goes on and they get interested in any kind of poetry, in jumping rope rhymes, or in hide and seek rhymes, or things like that, it can last, and it can be drummed out of them, and they may rediscover it later on. But I don't think it's alien. I mean, I think in other cultures, one of the great ironies of our language and our culture is that we have one of the richest poetries there's ever been in a language, and there's probably never been a language in which it's been so neglected. And maybe that's good for it, you know.
This in the last few years, I'm thinking about that in terms of your project. There's the Vixen, the poems, that these elegiac metered poems of the south of France. There is a long narrative poem, epic narrative poem about Hawaiian legend, book-length poem. There is this new book of poems that make their invention out of second-person address. And now you seem to keep finding ways to invent the project of poetry for yourself in new ways.
I keep trying to, Bob, and you encourage me to think that I have. But I feel that every time one changes slightly the mode of doing it, one doesn't change one's voice, one doesn't change one's mind. But every time, and this is something that I think writing students come to reluctantly sometimes, or with astonishment. Form, another mode or way of doing something, is not a straitjacket in which you show off that you can do it in spite of the straitjacket, but it's a kind of empowerment. It allows you to do things that you couldn't do in any other way. The sonnets of Shakespeare could not have been written without the sonnet form. You can take a sonnet of Shakespeare and break it down into contemporary prose and see what you've left with. You'll be very startled at what the result is. Howard Moss, as you remember, did some changing of Shakespearean sonnets into rapid fire contemporary American. You know, should I say you like a day in summer? And what have you got left, you know?
Howard Moss makes me think of New York in the 1950s. When you came back from Europe, that was where you were for a while. That was an enormously vital time in the American arts. Yes. What was it like for you?
Well, first I was in Boston, and I was fascinated by Boston.
To write a play.
To write a play for the Poets Theater. I had the ambition for several years that I wanted to write plays, and my life kept getting in the way. I was living in England, and I loved the English theater, but I thought, I couldn't possibly write a play for the English theater. And I came back, and I felt alien to what was going on in the American theater, because I just felt I'd been away for too long, and that I didn't have the freedom to just sort of hang out in the village and pick up things from what was going on in the theater then. So I wrote five plays, and I didn't like any of them, and I gave it up for the time being. Years later, I thought, yeah, there are ways I could have wanted to write plays, but they would have been very, very different, and they would have been more like Wilson's plays or something like that. Very, very, very more like surrealist plays.
So then you went from Boston to New York.
Boston to New York, and everything was happening. And you know, the New York School, and Don Allen, and the St. Mark's group, and Allen Ginsberg, and so forth. And it was fascinating. Everything seemed to be happening in New York, and I loved New York. It was very, very exciting to be there.
Was music or painting important to you in that time?
Yeah, and of course, you know, Bob Dylan was just beginning to hear the early, very early Bob Dylan. And it was wonderful being back. I've been 7 years away in Europe, and it was very, very exciting. And of course, the country, between the end of the 40s and the latter part of the 50s, in the early 50s, I don't know how it happened, But the country changed enormously. I mean, and it felt like a new place to me. And of course it had. I mean, the Beats had arrived in the poetry scene, Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones. I mean, the whole of music was different. Other kinds of music too. And everybody was trying everything, you know, and it was very exciting.
Did you edit the Nation's poetry for a while?
For a while, those years? Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of my great friends was George Kirstie. Through poetry that I published in the Nation, George wrote to me about a poem that had to do with a sea monster. And George wrote me a letter about having bumped into a blackfish at night when he was sailing. And he said, poem, make it sound as though you like sailing. And he said, if you do, I'd like to invite you to go sailing. So I went sailing with him, and we became lifelong friends. And he asked me to edit the poetry at the Nation for a while. He had the feeling, I suppose, that if he changed editors enough, he might understand more of the poetry. And I think he did. George pretended to not read much literature, but he'd written his thesis at Harvard on Hardy. I mean, he knew a lot about poetry.
In my sense, coming along a few years later and reading, there was a tremendous sense of excitement about this range of new poets and artists and new work in dance and theater.
Yeah.
And it became particularly strong that there were, at the time of the Civil Rights Movement and the early years of the movement against the Vietnam War, this powerful set of voices, including and especially yours. And it seemed that in the books I went to look at to see what the scholars and critics were saying about your early career, they tend to mark the transformation roughly between a book called The Drunk in the Furnace and the book after that.
The Moving Target.
Yeah, The Moving Target and then The Life. What happened to your poetry in those years?
It was about, I think, the end of the 50s when I finished The Drunk in the Furnace. I think I finished The Drunk in the Furnace about 1958, 59, somewhere along in there. And I had very strongly the feeling that I'd written to the end of something, and that it wasn't that there was anything the matter with that way of writing, but I didn't want to go on writing that way. And I had to find something else. And I knew that when I wrote again, because it's always a big if. Every time I've put down a poem and, as Valerie would say, abandoned it, I've had the feeling, well, there may not be another poem. I always feel that. I've felt that all my life. I think that's the right way to feel, too. I think Merriman said you have to get down on your knees to the muse, you know. If you tell the muse you're sure she's going to turn up again at Tuesday afternoon, she certainly is not going to do that. So when I began to write again, what you said was absolutely true. I'd read Neruda and I'd read the French surrealist, Breton, people of that kind, Breton in particular, who I still think is one of the best of them, back when I was in college. And I admired them very much, and they seemed to have practically nothing to do with what I was writing or what anybody else was writing or what seemed possible. And having made that break those years later, all of a sudden the day came completely by surprise, when I began to write another poem, and it was totally different, and then it was followed by several others, and then I began to realize that I was hearing not just Neruda, but Residencia en la Tierra, that one particular book, and Breton and all those people. They weren't close to my ear, but they made more sense. They seemed more akin than they had before, and more relevant to what could be done. And that was a great opening. And I sometimes that period is described as though a bunch of us got together and worked it all out like a committee meeting and decided that this is what we were going to do. And it didn't happen like that at all. We weren't aware, apart from Robert Bly and James Wright, I mean, Robert bullied James Wright into writing a different way, and James complained about it. But apart from that, a number of us went through that same change at about that same time. I don't think it had to do with the Beats or anything else, although it may have had to do with being able, oddly enough, reading the Latin American poets who had been heavily influenced by Whitman allowed one to go back and reread Whitman in a different way. And I think all of us did that. And without talking to each other about it. I think that's one of the wonderful things about it. We didn't sit down and hash this all out and decide on a new direction for American poetry. Nothing of the kind. It was wonderful to see it happening around us, though. Very exciting.
I remember picking up the Lice. I think I memorized some of those poems standing there reading them at the bookstore the first time. It was really a new sound. New, I don't know if I can get this right, new shadow. Is that what you are? Standing on the stairs of water, no longer afraid. Hope and grief are still our wings, why we cannot fly. I thought, whoa, what the hell is this? And I felt like in that book that a kind of, find a language for it, that a different kind of spirituality connected to a kind of politics because of the parables in that book that seemed to address the political situation had happened. It was a remarkable thing when it occurred. We've come to the end, and I wonder if we could ask you to read one more poem to finish off this evening.
I gave the, all the new poems.
I happen to have
into
a couple of books. There.
Let's see what I can find. Well, there's a poem that I didn't read that I could read now because it does bring together. One of the changes too was a lifelong, I mean, a period, all through those years, in different ways, thinking that what I was scanting was history in some ways. I mean, I envied writers who could bring the historic circumstance into their poems in ways that I felt I couldn't do, and I don't know. I can't go on with that because I don't know how much. But I know that was a feeling that I was trying to get round. Well, I felt that was something that I was failing to do, and that I wanted to do it more so, not have something too far out and too abstracted from the historic moment. And this is a poem that was written. The date is September 17th, 2001. So it's a week after what I will not refer to as 9/11. I hate calling it by a media nickname. I think we should have a proper name that respects it. And I wasn't thinking of writing poems at all. I was too shocked to think of writing anything. And these poems began, and this was the first of them. And it's in present company. It's one of the poems that's in the second person. It's called, the title is To the Words. When it happens, you are not there. O you beyond numbers, beyond recollection, passed on from breath to breath, given again from day to day, from age to age, charged with knowledge, knowing nothing. Indifferent elders, indispensable and sleepless, keepers of our names before ever we came to be called by them, you that were formed to begin with, you that were cried out, you that were spoken to begin with, to say what could not be said, ancient, precious, and helpless ones, say it.
William Merwin. Thank you for tonight. Thank you for your work.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Dantica, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.